Chapter 14, Mental Gender. Students of psychology who have followed the modern trend of thought along the lines of mental phenomena are struck by the persistence of the dual mind idea, which has manifested itself so strongly during the past 10 or 15 years, and which has given rise to a number of plausible theories regarding the nature and constitution of these two minds. The late Thomson J. Hudson attained great popularity in 1893 by advancing his well-known theory of the objective and subjective minds, which he held existed in every individual. Other writers have attracted almost equal attention by the theories regarding the conscious and subconscious minds, the voluntary and involuntary minds, the active and passive minds, etc., etc. The theories of the various writers differ from each other, but there remains the underlying principle of the duality of mind. The student of Hermetic philosophy is tempted to smile when he reads and hears of these many new theories regarding the duality of mind, each school adhering tenaciously to its own pet theories, and each claiming to have discovered the truth. The student turns back the pages of occult history, and away back in the dim beginnings of occult teachings, he finds references to the ancient Hermetic doctrine of the principle of gender on the mental plane, the manifestation of mental gender. And examining further, he finds that the ancient philosophy took cognizance of the phenomenon of the dual mind and accounted for it by the theory of mental gender. This idea of mental gender may be explained in a few words to students who are familiar with the modern theories just alluded to. The masculine principle of mind corresponds to the so-called objective mind, conscious mind, voluntary mind, active mind, etc. And the feminine principle of mind corresponds to the so-called subjective mind, subconscious mind, involuntary mind, passive mind, etc. Of course, the Hermetic teachings do not agree with the many modern theories regarding the nature of the two phases of mind, nor does it admit many of the facts claimed for the two respective aspects, some of the said theories and claims being far-fetched and incapable of standing the test of experiment and demonstration. We point to the phase of agreement merely for the purpose of helping the student to assimilate his previously acquired knowledge with the teachings of the Hermetic philosophy. Students of Hudson will notice the statement at the beginning of his second chapter of The Law of Psychic Phenomena that the mystic jargon of the Hermetic philosophers discloses the same general idea, that is, the duality of mind. If Dr. Hudson had taken the time and trouble to decipher a little of the mystic jargon of the Hermetic philosophy, he might have received much light upon the subject of the dual mind, but then perhaps his most interesting work might not have been written. Let us now consider the Hermetic teachings regarding mental gender. The Hermetic teachers impart their instruction regarding this subject by bidding their students examine the report of their consciousness regarding their self. The students are bidden to turn their attention inward upon the self dwelling within each. Each student is led to see that his consciousness gives him, first, a report of the existence of his self. The report is, I am. This, at first, seems to be the final words from the consciousness. But a little further examination discloses the fact that this I am may be separated or split into two distinct parts or aspects, which, while working in unison and in conjunction, yet, nevertheless, may be separated in consciousness. Well, at first, there seems to be only an I existing. A more careful and closer examination reveals the fact that there exist an I and a me. These mental twins differ in their characteristics and nature, and an examination of their nature and the phenomenon arising from the same will throw much light upon many of the problems of mental influence. Let us begin with the consideration of the me, which is usually mistaken for the I by the student, unless he presses the inquiry a little farther back into the recesses of consciousness. A man thinks of himself in its aspect of me as being composed of certain feelings, tastes, likes, dislikes, habits, peculiar ties, characteristics, etc., all of which go to make up his personality or the self known to himself and others. He knows that these emotions and feelings change, are born and die away, are subject to the principle of rhythm and the principle of polarity, which take from him one extreme of feeling to another. He also thinks of the me as being certain knowledge gathered together in his mind and thus forming a part of himself. This is the me of a man, but we have proceeded too hastily. The me of many men may be said to consist largely of their consciousness of the body and their physical appetites, etc. Their consciousness being largely bound up with their bodily nature, they practically live there. Some men even go so far as to regard their personal apparel as a part of their me and actually seem to consider it a part of themselves. A writer has humorously said that men consist of three parts: soul, body, and clothes. These clothes-conscious people would lose their personality if divested of their clothing by savages upon the occasion of a shipwreck. But even many who are not so closely bound up with the idea of personal raiment stick closely to the consciousness of their bodies being their me. They cannot conceive of a self independent of the body. Their mind seems to them to be practically a something belonging to their body, which in many cases it is indeed. But as man rises in the scale of consciousness, he is able to disentangle his me from his idea of body and is able to think of his body as belonging to the mental part of him. But even then, he is very apt to identify the me entirely with the mental states, feelings, etc., which he feels to exist within him. He is very apt to consider these internal states as identical with himself, instead of there being simply things produced by some part of his mentality and existing within him, of him, and in him, but still not himself. He sees that he may change these internal state of feelings by all effort of will, and that he may produce a feeling or state of an exactly opposite nature in the same way, and yet the same me exists. And so after a while, he is able to set aside these various mental states, emotions, feelings, habits, qualities, characteristics, and other personal mental belongings. He is able to set them aside in the not-me collection of curiosities and encumbrances, as well as valuable possessions. This requires much mental concentration and power of mental analysis on the part of the student, but still, the task is possible for the advanced student. And even those not so far advanced are able to see in the imagination how the process may be performed. After this laying aside process has been performed, the student will find himself in conscious possession of a self which may be considered in its I and me dual aspects. The me will be felt to be something mental in which thoughts, ideas, emotions, feelings, and other mental states may be produced. It may be considered as the mental womb, as the ancients styled it, capable of generating mental offspring. It reports to the consciousness as a me with latent powers of creation and generation, of mental progeny of all sorts and kinds. Its powers of creative energy are felt to be enormous, but still, it seems to be conscious that it must receive some form of energy from either its eye companion or else from some other I, ere it is able to bring into being its mental creations. This consciousness brings with it a realization of an enormous capacity for mental work and creative ability. But the student soon finds that this is not all that he finds within his inner consciousness. He finds that there exists a mental something which is able to will that the me act along certain creative lines, and which is also able to stand aside and witness the mental creation. This part of himself he is taught to call his I. He is able to rest in its consciousness at will. He finds there not a consciousness of an ability to generate and actively create, in the sense of the gradual process attendant upon mental operations, but rather a sense and consciousness of an ability to project an energy from the I to the me, a process of willing that the mental creation begin and proceed. He also finds that the I is able to stand aside and witness the operations of the me's mental creation and generation. There is this dual aspect in the mind of every person. The I represents the masculine principle of mental gender. The me represents the female principle. The I represents the aspect of being, the me the aspect of becoming. You will notice that the principle of correspondence operates on this plane just as it does upon the great plane upon which the creation of the universes is performed.